God bless you. Happy Easter and welcome to the Keep Up Alive with Reverend Jesse Jackson, the radio program. This is Reverend Jesse Jackson, and this morning I wish you a happy and glorious Easter. But brothers and sisters, I encourage those of you who are listening today to tell your friends about us and listen to us live on the web on Sunday mornings from 7 to 8 a.m. Central Time, 8 to 9 a.m. Eastern Time on your website, on our website, keepupaliveradio.com. And please email us with your thoughts and comments. We want to hear from you. So drop us an email throughout the week at the same address, keepupaliveradio.com. This Easter week, a week of challenges, agonizing challenges, the outer limits of our faith and resurrection. We're on a journey of agony and faith with regard to Terri Schiavo. We've been riveted to TV and radio reports all of this week, these last few weeks, as a matter of fact. Terri's case is an extraordinary challenge to our patience, our faith, our ethics, and our morality. A brain-impaired woman said to be brain dead, she is being starved and dehydrated to death. She must not be a trophy, a monument, and merely for a moment. Her crisis challenges us to deal with long-term health care for all Americans. In her case, they did not pull the plug to assist her in breathing. They pulled the tube, cut off the water, and would not even allow ice for her parched lips. For this level of cruelty, there is no moral justification. But what can I say today about our very special guest this morning? This legendary singer, dancer, songwriter, extraordinary, has transfixed the role for more than 40 years. He became an instant star at age 11 as the front man in Motown's phenomenally successful family act, the Jackson 5, one of the best-selling groups of all time. Kicking off their Motown tenure in 1969 with the unprecedented feat of four consecutive number one singles. Who Can Forget I Want You Back, ABC, Mama's Pearl, or I'll Be There. Where were you when you were having barely turned 13? He began his solo career, released a successful string of solo singles that included Got to Be There, Rockin' Robin, and Ben. We've all marveled at as he continued to scale unprecedented heights with the success of three of the biggest selling albums of all time, Off the Wall, Thriller, and Bad. Indeed, Thriller is the biggest selling album of all time, having sold 51 million copies worldwide. Beyond the numbers, how important and paradigm-shifting has Jackson's recording, shattering record, how phenomenal has it really been? What a phenomenal feat. As producer Quincy Jones told Time magazine, black music had to play second fiddle for a long time, but his spirit is the whole motor of pop. He has connected with every soul in the world. He's been proclaimed the biggest selling artist of all time, the single most awarded entertainer the world has ever known, the most popular artist in the history of show business, and not so modestly, the world's most famous man, and of course, the king of pop. I could, and the world still goes on about this genius, about this icon for the ages. Brothers and sisters, members of the Keep Up Alive family, today we have the rare opportunity to take a journey from Gary to greatness and hear the king of pop share the story of his life as only he can tell it. It's with great pride and pleasure that I bring to you this morning Michael Jackson from California. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning, Jesse. How are you?
Good, good, good. Good to hear you. There are many listening ears around America and the world for our conversation today.
Well,
good, 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 good. Well, my friends, let's get this conversation started as we have a shared conversation with our nation. Stay right there. You don't want to miss this live conversation. The king of pop, Michael Jackson, will be right back with Keep Hope Alive with Reverend Jesse Jackson.
Visit us online at keephopealiveradio.com. And while you're there, you can click the link to send us an email or listen online live. That's keephopealiveradio.com.
Ever wonder who coined the phrase, we eliminate the middleman?
Hey, KML Easter Bunny.
And, you know, it's Easter. We're going to do the egg thing, you know.
Hey, you're not the Easter Bunny.
Shut up!
Damn, kids. Listen all weekend.
Hey, what's this?
Hey, wait. Put down my eggs before you break. Oh, man, I broke my Easter egg.
There's prizes inside.
Every time an egg cracks, call 106 Good Score, a gas card, or some other Easter goodie.
Prizes!
To win a PSP handheld. Chewy picks the grand prize winner. 106 KMEL.
106 KMEL.
The People's Station.
To have you.
station, 106 KMEL.
What's up, y'all? This is Tupac, Machiavelli the Don, and you are riding on the west side with the People Station, 106 KMEL.
When you listen, I catch you paying attention to my business as a rider. I'm a straight rider. My business as a rider.
The People Station, 106 KMEL.
Hey, yo, they don't do it like us.
So fly, I got money, so that's a good enough reason about the things I buy. I'm so, I'm on point, and I can tell that you're jealous by the look in your eye. When I ride by, I don't care. You just going straight to the top this year. I'm so fly, I got money, so that's a good enough.
106 KMEL.
Yo, what's cracking, KMEL? Yo, this your boy,
Hey, y'all, what's up? This is Foxy Brown on the People Station, 106
To hear from you, please email your questions or comments to Reverend Jesse Jackson at keephopealiveradio.com.
Welcome to Keep Hope Alive with Reverend Jesse Jackson, our regular Sunday morning talk show. Today we have a phenomenal guest in Michael Jackson. Michael has taken this phenomenal journey from ground zero to outer space. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning, Jesse. How are you?
Good, good. You remember we met... 47th Street, way many years ago. Your father brought you and the guys by the office in your station wagon and U-Haul. You're performing at the Regal Theater. Do you remember that?
Yes, I do remember. It was a long time ago. I was just very little.
What do you remember about that period?
Oh, I remember what we were wearing, kind of like darshikis and bell-bottom pants. And I just remember the love from the public was very great in accepting what we had to offer. And the support from, the people at that time was just beautiful. The black people was fantastic.
Did you
were always very kind to us as well.
Good, good. Did your mom make those outfits?
Yes, she did. She always made all of our clothes. My mother would sew and stitch everything. Everything we wore as before really making it at Motown.
I remember so well that Junius Griffin came up with your dad and asked, could you guys be a warm-up act at Expo? And we had to make room for you in our schedule. then you guys stole the show.
Oh, I remember those shows.
And then
you had a big afro at the time.
Don't remind people of that, Michael. You did so very well. But during that time, you were just getting hooked up with Motown. Who discovered you for Motown?
Well, in complete truth, it was Gladys Knight and a guy named Bobby Taylor. And they were on the bill of some of the shows we were doing. They used to be like, you would do a show and there would be 20 to 30 acts. It was very much like vaudeville. You would do just a certain amount of songs and you would go off. And they were always on these shows and they would watch us. And they were so impressed with what we were doing. And Berry Gordy wasn't interested at first, but eventually he loved us and wanted to sign us. And after being signed, since Diana Ross was their biggest star at the time, they used her as the vehicle to introduce us to the public. The first album was called Diana Ross Present the Jackson Five.
At that time, who were your favorite artists?
Oh, God, I love Diana Ross, and I love James Brown, and I still do. I love all these artists still to this day. I love Jackie Wilson, the real showstoppers, the real entertainers. Sammy Davis Jr., I loved him as well.
Did you get any interview moves from Jackie Wilson?
Oh, yes, of course. All of these artists inspired me very much. I couldn't help from being inspired by these great entertainers.
A little later, remember we were out in Los Angeles, and at that time, Suzanne DePass was the godmother for the group, and she had you and Fred Siegel shopping for some jeans.
Yes. You remember Suzanne DePass? She was so wonderful. She was pretty much our manager with my father at the time. And Tony Jones, they were all wonderful people, and I thank them from the bottom of my heart,
She was such a wonderful person, and she remains. She's so top-notch in that what she does.
Yes, she is. She was very helpful and instrumental in the early days with our career, and she remains a friend, and I do miss her. I haven't seen her in a while, but she's a wonderful person. So is Berry Gordy.
Michael, in this whole developmental period, I would call it Ground Zero, like Gary and the Regal Theater and the Expo and the early meeting of Barry Gordy and Motown. As you reflect, what's this period what about it do you remember the most?
Which period is this now?
This kind of Gary to the Regal Theater to Expo to meeting Gladys Knight to going to Motown. What about this period that stands out the most in your mind?
This period, for me, what stands out is, because I was so young around 8 or 9. I just remember the environment, what it was like, all the music I was hearing, because my father played guitar, my uncle played guitar, and every day they would come over and they would start, playing great music, and we would start to perform to the music. And I remember seeing marching bands go down the street, and I remember the rhythm of the band and the beats of the drum, and every sound around me seemed to record in my head and start making rhythms and dancing. And I used to dance to the rhythm of the washing machine. If my mother went to the corner store to wash the clothes, I would dance to the rhythm, and people would crowd around. I remember those kind of stories. They would crowd around pretty much and watch me. Those kind of little things. It's just reflections, really.
Well, you remember you said that Jackie Wilson and James Brown and Sammy Davis were heroes. Did you ever see them perform?
Yes, of course I did, and they were friends of mine, all these great artists. That's where I was so lucky, because I was this little kid looking up to these people. We were real catatonic, awestruck with their talent. And not only did I get to see it, but I got to see it close up, right on the side of the curtain, on the side of the wings, and I got to know these great artists. These were the best entertainers in the world. They were showstoppers, and I would have to go on stage sometime after them, So it was amazing.
But the thing is that at first, I remember Tito and Jermaine, you were like so little and so small. You were just a part of the Jackson 5. At what point did you realize that you were a showstopper?
When you have a special ability, you don't realize it because you think everybody else has the same gift that you have, so you don't realize it. When I used to sing at such a young age, people were so inspired by my singing, and they loved it, and I didn't realize why they were clapping or crying or start to scream. I really, truly didn't, Jesse. And I think think it was just later on in life when people would come to me and say, you know, do you realize you have a special gift or you have a special talent? And I just remember from my mother, who's very religious, always telling us to always thank God, thank Jehovah God for your talent, your ability. You know, it's not from, it's not our doing, it's from above. So we were always humbled by people who would come with accolades or, you know, adulation, whatever it is, you know, and it was a beautiful thing.
When did you stop going to school formally?
Oh, that was very young. I think it was, oh boy. I think the fifth, probably the fifth grade, fourth or fifth, I think. And then I had tutoring the rest of my life because we did so many tours and concerts and TV shows and then all the albums and the recordings because we would have 3 hours of schooling, then we would do the concerts, and then we would travel to another state or another country. And then by that time, you know, we'd do some concerts again. Then it would be time to record the next J5 album. Then after the J5 album, it's time for another Michael Jackson album. So I was in my youth, as a little kid, I was always busy. I remember across the street from Motown recording studio, there was a park. And I used to hear the roar of the kids and the throwing of the football and the basketball. And I remember going to the studio every day, and I would feel kind of sad because I wanted to go to that park. But I knew I had a different job to do, you know, so we'd go in and make the records all day until late at night. Then you go to sleep and you're up for the next day, just the same regimentation.
But to that extent, you missed a certain body of childhood experience. How did you compensate for this loss of ordinary childhood experience?
Well, it's true, I didn't have a childhood. But when you don't have a childhood, like people like myself and other child stars, I would think you try to compensate for the loss. So later on, you try to catch up. And that's why you see, like, you may see it. Theme park or amusement rides or that kind of environment at my home. But I like to do it to help other children who are less fortunate than I am. You know, kids who are terminally ill, kids with diseases, poor children from the inner cities, you know, the ghettos, to let them see the mountains or to see, go on the rides or to watch a movie or to have some ice cream or something.
The other thing, of course, that was different about you, Michael, you did have a family. How many was in the family?
The immediate Jackson family?
Yeah.
It was originally 10 of us. There's nine. And my mother, Catherine and Joseph Jackson, are still alive, and they were all born in Gary, Indiana.
Well, in that setting, did Tito and Jermaine beat up on you and give you some normal childhood experience of being a little brother?
Yeah, well, being on tour, like we would go to Miami, and we would, you know, we would be able to use the beaches, and but we were so popular at the time. Wherever the Jackson 5 would go, there would be mob scenes. We couldn't go in a shopping center or anywhere. It would be just kids screaming, and so we had hit records back to back to back. We were playing these sellouts, big arenas across America, and so it was difficult. So we did have a chance to have some fun, but in the hotel. There would be a pillow fight in the hotel, or if we wanted to swim after hours, you know, we would swim in the pool downstairs, you know, that type of thing.
Who would win the pillow fights?
Pretty much Tito or Jackie. They were the oldest.
Given all that you've kind of gone through in this kind of phenomenal rise, the artists who've sold the most records in history, as you look back from that period, what we might call ground zero, to the period of your maturing and writing, who was your greatest influence in learning to write? You write so well.
My greatest influence in learning to write music, I think this is where I was lucky. Cause in my opinion, I came into the factory of the greatest songwriters at that time and in the 60s, Holland Dozier Holland of Motown. These three guys were phenomenal. You know, Lamont Dozier, Eddie Holland. I mean, these guys were amazing. They wrote all the great Supreme hits and the four top hits. They just were amazing. And I got to learn and work with these guys. And I love some of the, of course, some of the Beatles stuff. And I love the Beatles music, actually. And I love I love a lot of the show tune writers, Richard Rodgers and Oscar Hammerstein and Lerner and Lowe and Harold Arlen and Johnny Mercer and, you know, these kind of show tune, because I love melody. I love the great Irish pub songs. I love English melody. But and the rhythms of Africa, which are the roots of rhythm, that's my favorite music, because I think that's the favorite music of the world, because all music is derived from that. I mean, Africa is music. It is the origin. You know, it is the dawn of existence. And so you can't avoid that. So that's in everything that's been influenced, you know, by myself.
But so much, as you went through these stages and you began to write and sing and dance, did you have, like, a dancing coach?
No, I never studied dancing before. It always came natural for me. Whenever I was little, any music was starting, they couldn't set me down. They couldn't tie me down, actually. And even to this day, if somebody plays a beat, I'll start kicking in, making counter rhythms to the beat I'm hearing. It's just a natural instinct. And I've never studied in Fred Astaire, who was a good friend of mine, and Gene Kelly. I used to always marvel at my ability for dance. And when I was a little kid, Fred Astaire used to always tell me how he felt in his heart that I was going to be a very special star. And I used to just look at him thinking, what are you talking about? But he could see, you know.
Michael, where did the moonwalk come from?
The moonwalk is a dance that I would love to take credit for, but I can't, because I have to be completely honest here. These black children in the ghettos they have the most phenomenal rhythm of anybody on the earth. I'm not joking. I get a lot of ideas from watching black children, and they have perfect rhythm. So just riding through Harlem, I remember in the early, you know, late 70s, the early 80s, I would see these kids dancing on the street, and I saw a kid doing this kind of sliding backwards, kind of illusion dancing, I call it. And I took a mental picture of it, a mental movie of it, and I went into my room upstairs in Encino, and I started to just do it and dance and create and perfect it. But it definitely started within black culture, no doubt. And that's where it comes from.
Well, then, kind of connected to that piece of it, while you were dancing, did you watch Don Kinesin and Soul Train?
Oh, I love that show. Are you kidding? Of course I did. I would wait for the Soul Train line. They would have a line they would make of like a wall of people, and a dancer would come through the middle dancing to the song, and that would give them a chance to showcase their talent and what they can do with their body creatively. I used to watch that catatonically, just watching that. I was mesmerized by studying the rhythms and the dancing, of course. Of course I watched it.
Michael, you know, as you look back, you've kind of made this kind of transition from ground zero in Gary, and you began to ascend. Then you became a man, in many ways, in a child's body. I mean, you never gained any weight. How did you manage?
Well, I've never been a great eater. I've, to tell a little secret, I hate to tell it, but I've never been a great great eater or a great admirer of food, even though I appreciate food and the gift of food and how God has given us food to eat. But my mother has always had a hard time with me all my life, forcing me to eat. Elizabeth Taylor used to feed me, hand feed me at times, because I do have a problem with eating, but I do my very best, and I am eating. Yes, I am. So I don't want anybody to think I'm starving. I'm not.
But
my health is perfect, actually.
You maintain this weight, man. That's what people are most jealous of and excited about.
No, my health is perfect, actually. I'm a great believer in holistic natural foods and eating and where I eat, you know, and herbs and things. You know, God's medicine instead of Western chemicals, not those things, you know.
You know, Michael, as you look back over this phenomenal career, you remember at least the fifth grade in Gary and how you guys became a big hit so quickly. What do you remember? What is to you the high point? You know, I've asked people all week long the high point for them. It may have been Thriller. It may have been Beat It. It may have been some performance. What for you represents a kind of a high point?
Well, one of the great high points, I would have to say, because I remember before 82, like early 80s, I had done an album called Off the Wall, and Off the Wall, it was an important point for me because I had just done the movie The Wiz, and I wanted to express myself as a writer, as an artist, you know, to write my own music, to do the music, to pretty much put it together. And Quincy Jones, who I loved, I was fortunate enough to work with him, and I love this man, and he's very gifted. But I was writing these songs at the time, like Don't Stop Till You Get Enough, you know, Shake Your Body Down to the Ground, you know, Billie Jean and Beat It. All these songs were written at this time. So I pretty much were setting mental goals of what I want to do as an artist. And that was a high point for me during the winning of the Grammys for the Off the Wall album. But I wasn't happy because I wanted to do much more than that. And I wasn't happy with, you know, the way it was accepted, even though it was a huge success. It was the biggest selling album for the solo artist at that time. It was over 10 million. And, for black solo artists. And I said the next album, I refused for them to ignore. And that's when I set my heart on writing the Thriller album. And I said...
Yeah, really, what gave rise to the Thriller?
Pardon?
What gave rise to the Thriller?
What gave rise to Thriller was at the time I was pretty much disappointed and hurt. I lived in an area called Encino, and I used to see signs of graffiti saying disco sucks, disco is this and disco is that, and disco was just a happy medium of making people dance at the time. But it was so popular that the society was turning against it. I said, I'm just going to do a great album, because I love the album that Tchaikovsky did, Nutcracker Suite. It's an album where every song is like a great song. I said, I want to do an album where every song is like a hit record. And that's what pretty much hit Thriller respond from that. And I did that album, and it made all-time history. The Guinness Book of World Record proclaimed it as the largest-selling album of all time, and it is still to this day. And I would say that was a pinnacle. That was I reached a certain zenith point, I would think, but I still wasn't pleased after that. I was always wanting to do more, wanting to do more. And the Victory Tour came along.
At some point, you reached out before we get to the Victory Tour, and we had this phenomenal crisis of people dying, and you use your celebrity to pull the artists together to do We Are the World.
Yes.
What was that like?
We Are the World was a great project because Quincy Jones called me on the phone and he asked me to write a song for the devastation that's going on in Africa, and Ethiopia was hit very badly. And he knew my love for the people over there, because I go to Africa all the time. I love the culture. I love the people. I love what they represent. And so I put this song together. He said, let Lionel Richie help you. So Lionel came over. We started, you know, putting ideas together. And we talked most of the time, because we pretty much caught up with old times, because I've been knowing Lionel Richie for many, many years. And so Lionel and I put something together, but I wasn't happy with it completely. So after that, I just went in the studio myself and pretty much completed it and finished it and packaged it and did all the music and put everything together and turned it in. And Quincy was very impressed with it, and he said, this is the song, we're going to go with it. And we put the song out. It became the biggest selling single in history, and it raised a lot of money. It was called USA for Africa. And we heightened public awareness on the subject. It was Relief for Africa. It was a beautiful thing. We gave a certain percentage to America, but the majority share went to Africa. It was a great, great thing.
Michael, I'm going to take a little break right now and come back and talk about the Victory Tour.
Okay.
And the Push Expo Femme, Save the Children, okay. And what your present challenges are, okay?
Okay.
We'll be right back.
Visit us online at KeepHopeAliveRadio.com. And while you're there, you can click the link to send us an email or listen online live. That's KeepHopeAliveRadio.com.
106 KMEL, the People's Station, the Bay Area's home for hip hop and R&B. 106 KMEL,
station.
106 KMEL,
Bay Area's home for hip hop and R&B.
The People's Station, 106 KMEL.
Make them nosy neighbors want to call the cops. Hiking in them scrapers in them drop tops. Hiking crooked up and down the block. Hiking pulling off a wall shot. Hiking make a baby mama slap a baby daddy. Hiking dashing all on the hood of your potty caddy. Hiking if you're going stupid, yo, yo, yo.
106 KMEL.
y'all. This is Jay-Z jamming on the People Station 106 KMEL.
We want to hear from you. Please email your questions or comments to Reverend Jesse Jackson at KeepHopeAliveRadio.com.
Ramon, will you get us a copy?
Yes.
Welcome back, Reverend Jesse Jackson. Keep Hope Alive, a very special edition today with Michael Jackson. People are listening all around the nation, all around the world. Just a kind of family talk with Michael. I've known him since he was like 7 years old, but the entire family. At some point in time, his father, driving a station wagon with a U-Haul, brought the guys by our office one day and asked if they'd be a warm-up act for Expo. And, of course, they were a warm-up act, but in fact, they set it on fire. And the Expo was never quite the same again. Matter of fact, Michael, you know, we did the film Save the Children. That was a big hit, too.
Yes, it was. Yes, it was. I remember those times. They were... It's a little cloudy, but I do remember it, Jesse, and I remember how wonderful you were to us, and I remember the love from the audience, and I could hear the screaming of the crowd, and I could see all the afros and the dashikis, and it was just a wonderful time. It was for a wonderful crowd.
On that show was Marvin Gaye and Roberta Flack and the OJs and the Staples Singers and Cannonball Adderley. It was a huge deal.
That's amazing, amazing list of people. That's some of the greatest talent ever. That's amazing.
We're going to re-release Save the Children sometime pretty soon, and people who missed that period will really enjoy watching it. Michael, you know, we think about the kind of rise from here when you were but a child, and then you went through your teenage years being tutored along. But then I remember another phase, I think it's another phase, when the Victory Tour occurred. At that time, you were a full-grown. All of your brothers and sisters were full-grown. And we met in Kansas City. Remember with your family?
Yes.
And we all had prayer together.
Yes,
The Victory Tour. Describe that season.
The Victory Tour was one of the great pinnacles of my success because Thriller had won more Grammys than any other album in the history of music. And it created so much phenomenon and such adulation and notoriety on a universal level that it was very, very hard to go anywhere, do anything without press and helicopters and people sleeping in your bushes and hiding in your trees. And it was just a phenomenal pinnacle. It really was. And then after all of that, I announced that I was going to tour and to tour and to perform those songs live in front of an audience. So the world was just going really, really wild at that time. And we did this tour that broke records all over America. We played stadiums. For instance, the setting record at Dodger Stadium before we played it was One Show and a Half by Elton John. We did 8 shows there, sold out, and they wanted another 2. So we did 8 sold out shows there. But this happened all over America. The first city was Kansas City, and that's where we met with you, Jesse. And I remember you coming to the suite, and you gave prayer. And it was a beautiful thing, and it was just an amazing time. It really was. My dreams had come true.
Good, good. But you know, Michael, in this life, it is said some rain must fall, and you've had these seasons of just tailwinds, like pushing you forward. But life is of such, it's not a straight line. Some argue you're either in a storm, or you're just leaving a storm and going to a storm. And it's not difficult to handle the sunshine of bright skies, tailwind days, but then these headwinds come that kind of test what you really are made of. It kind of tests your metal, your true grit. And so you've had these high points. What do you consider to be the low point?
Probably the low point, the lowest point emotionally and experience probably what I'm going through.
in the sense, what about it that's just kind of stung you?
What about it that what?
That stung you, so to speak.
Use the word again.
Stung. I mean, it's kind of hurt you. You say this low point.
Yeah, just the pain of what I'm going through, to be accused of something where I know in my heart and in my experiences in life I'm totally innocent. And it's just very painful. But this has been kind of a pattern among black luminaries in this country.
And so since you're going through this and you feel the pain and you think it's a kind of pattern, how are you handling it spiritually? Because you go from being held so high, and now your very character, your integrity is under attack. How are you handling it?
I'm handling it by using other people in the past who have gone through this sort of thing. Mandela's story has given me a lot of strength, what he's gone through. The Jack Johnson story, which was on TBS, is on DVD now. It's called Unforgivable Blackness. It's an amazing story about this man from 1910 who was the heavyweight champion of the world and thrust into a society that didn't want to accept his position and his lifestyle and what they put him through and how they changed laws to imprison the man, to put him away behind bars, just to get him some kind of way. And Muhammad Ali's story, all these great, Jesse Owens' story, all these stories that I can go back in history and read about give me strength, Jesse. Your story gives me strength, what you went through. Because I came in at the tail end of the civil rights movement. I'm a 70s child, really. But I got at the tail end of the civil rights movement, I got to see it, you know?
And so you've had these hits. And people that you have embraced are now facing you in court on a daily basis. How does your spirit handle that?
I gain strength from God. I believe in Jehovah God very much. And I gain strength from the fact that I know I'm innocent. None of these stories are true. They're totally fabricated. And it's very sad and it's very, very painful. And I pray a lot. And that's how I deal with it. And I'm a strong person. I'm a warrior. And I know what's inside of me. I'm a fighter. But it's very painful. At the end of the day, I'm still human. You know, I'm still a human being. So it does hurt very, very, very much.
You know, I watched last week, you and I were talking on the phone, and there was this rhythm of the trial, which we will not get into at all today. But then they shifted from the focus of the trial to saying you are broke. And last week, people were calling in all around the nation saying, is Michael broke? Michael, are you broke?
That's not true at all. It's just one of their many schemes to embarrass me and to just drag me through mud. And it's the same pattern, like I told you, with these other people in the past. It's the same pattern. So don't believe any of this, you know, this is tabloid, sensationalized kind of gossip.
Well, how did the money issue get it in the first place? A number of people called saying they thought it was about the Sony catalog. What's in that catalog?
In my Sony catalog is all the Beatles music, all of, you know, Little Richard's music. I own Sly and the Family Stone. I own such a volume of so many. I own Elvis songs, and it's a huge catalog. It's very valuable. It's worth a lot of money, and there is a big fight going on right now as we speak about that. Now, I can't say whether or not. I can't comment on it. There's a lot of conspiracy. I'll say there's a lot of conspiracy going on as we speak.
Well, it was suggested by a number of your friends and family members that this fight really is more about this catalog issue than it is anything else. Do you believe that?
Well, you know, I don't want to comment. I don't want to make a comment, Jesse. It's a real delicate issue, and I'll let you make the comment on that one.
Let me shift this to the extent. since so many people are listening and there have been so many opinions, I was in London a couple of weeks ago, and 24/7, was Michael Jackson all day and all night long. And the day that you came to the hospital late and you said you were injured, what happened that day?
I was coming out of the shower, and I fell. And all my body weight, I mean, I'm pretty fragile, all my body weight fell against my rib cage. And I pretty much, I bruised my lung very badly. My lung on the right is very much me. I'm in pain as we speak. And I've been going to court every day in immense pain, in agonizing pain. And I sit there and I'm strong. I try to be as strong as I can. So I can, what we're looking for is the coughing of blood now. Because the doctor said I should, it could be very, he said it's still very dangerous as we speak. And if I cough the blood, he said it's a very dangerous thing. So we're still watching it very closely.
The cynic said you were faking. And it seemed that the judge at first was not willing even to believe you, even though you had just left the hospital.
Yeah, no, there's no faking with this at all. I mean, there was a scan done, and you could see the swelling on my whole rib cage. I mean, it was you could see it, and it's bright, bright red, and how it busted my chin, and it put a huge gash over my forehead. The blood, it was very bad, actually. And we're treating it. Actually, we're treating it. I do have medicine for it, but we're watching it very closely.
As I'm listening, you talk about this whole ordeal you've gone through and how you've stood strong, sometimes amazingly so. At some point last week, you cried. What touched you? What made you break down, as it were?
You mean at court?
Yeah.
I was in pain. I was sitting there hurting. And the pain was so immense, all I could do was just sit there and cry, because it was so intense at that moment. I just couldn't handle it, so I just grabbed tissue and just put it, you know, to my face.
So it was more about your personal pain than the challenges from the stand?
No, it had nothing to do with what was going on inside. It was total with personal pain, physical pain.
Michael, since so many people listening, I'm trying to glean from some of our calls on the phone today and from last week. As people listen to you, and what do you want people to know? Those who listen to you today on the phones, hear calls from Philadelphia and from Holland and from Britain and New York and Mississippi and Florida, California. What do you want people to know?
About
you, about where you are now in the head, how you're feeling.
Well, pretty much to be strong for me, to pray for my children and my family and myself. This is a very difficult time, and to not believe what they hear and see and read. Just because it's in print does not make it. Just because it's in print does not make it the gospel. And you know, because they're sensationalizing this thing to an immense degree, it's a feeding frenzy. It's because of my celebrity. The bigger the celebrity, the bigger the target. And they have to remember that. So they've turned this into money. It's like who get the biggest rating, who get the, you know, it's terrible what's happened with it. But it's part of what I have to suffer as a celebrity. It's part of what I have to go through. And to just know in the end I'll be vindicated, I pray, because I know the truth. I'm an innocent person, and I believe in God and love God. And just continue to pray for us.
You know that given your faith in God and in yourself and your declaration of innocence and while you're going through the storm, presuming that you win this has been a close battle, a very tense battle, because the battle is not over. The appearance, given your relationship, has called for lots of consternation. Is there anything that you will do differently when this season is over?
Is there anything that I would do differently?
Differently when this season is over.
My level of trust will change, and because there's a lot of conspiracy going on. I'll say that much. A lot of it.
Do you think
all around me?
Is the conspiracy connected to the celebrity, or to the trial, or to the catalog? What do you think the source of it is?
I can't come in, Jesse. I don't want to, because I'm under gag order, and it's a very, very serious thing. I don't want to say the wrong thing with the wrong flavor.
Well,
it's a very delicate area. It's a very delicate where we are now.
Good, good. Let me ask you this question, though, that for those who are praying fervently and who in some way want to help and look forward to Michael Jackson again, what can people expect next from you?
Well, like I always say, I'm a person of the arts. I love the arts very, very, very much. And I'm a musician. I'm a director. I'm a writer. I'm a composer. I'm a producer. And I love the medium. I love film very, very much. I think it's the most expressive of all the art mediums. The sculptor can sculpt, the painter can paint, but they capture a moment. They freeze time with the moment. And film, you live the moment. You live. You have the audience for 2 hours. You have their brain, their mind, and you can take them any place you want to take them. You know, and that idea is mesmerizing to me, that you can have the power to do that, to move people, to change their lives. And that's where you marry the music and the visual together. And that's what excites me so much about film and the future, because I love motion picture very, very much.
Given the heat that's on you and the attacks that you are facing now, does it deter you from pursuing your career when this is over?
No, no, not at all, because I know who I am inside and outside, and I know what I want to do. And I will always, go with my dreams and my ideals in life. And I'm a very courageous person, and I believe in perseverance and determination and all those wonderful things. And those ideals are very, very important for a person who's goal-oriented, you know?
Since people have risen so high and so far with your dreams, what are you... what are you dreaming up now?
Oh, like I was saying before, is to innovate and to pioneer the medium of film. And there's other things I want to do, which are some surprises, things in society that I want to do in the future. You know, in Africa, I have some great plans that I've been preparing to do there. I had several meetings with people who's flown out to see me since I've been going through what I'm going through. And so my heart is set on doing some things there, very much so as well.
Your next project, because often people are in a stage like this, they're just kind of frozen. But you were thinking about next projects. What do you see as like the next immediate project? What's hitting you right now?
Probably the tsunami song that we want to do to raise money for tsunami, because Africa, I think it was it Madagascar? One of those
Indeed, Madagascar.
Somalia and Madagascar was hit very hard, and they never talk about that the way they talk about the other countries. Now we have, my heart is going out for everybody, but at least when they distribute the truth, distribute it right, and they never talk about what the devastation down in Africa. So I want to do something for that. And of course, I've been working on planning a resort that I'm building down in Africa, a beautiful hotel and just a beautiful setting for people and families, and something beautiful down there. Because they have a lot of beautiful places down there, but I want to do something that's more international, you know?
Well, you know what's interesting about the tsunami, with this huge natural disaster? It couldn't be stopped. Maybe if we had had earlier detection devices, we could have saved some lives, perhaps. But it was a natural disaster. And what you've raised is that, while we've lost 200,000 in the tsunami, we've lost 2 million in the Sudan. And that's a man-made disaster. And oil and materials all caught up in that stuff. And then 4 million in the Congo. And I think that as we talk about it, and you and I talk almost every day, you're reaching out to these African crises appears to have taken up a large part of your dreams at this stage of your life.
Yes, it has, because, Jesse, in my heart, in my deepest of heart, I really love Africa, and I love the people of Africa, and that's why whenever I get the chance, my children and I, we jump on the plane, and we fly to Africa, and we vacation there. I spent more of my vacations in Africa than any other country. And we love the people, and we love the environment. Topographically, it's one of the most beautiful places on the surface of the earth. They never show the sandy white sugar beaches, and it's there. They never show the beautiful, you know, the landscaping. They never show the buildings, the metropolis of Durban, you know, Johannesburg, Cape Town, Kenya, you know, the Ivory Coast. You know, Rwanda, they never show how beautiful the place is. And it's really stunningly beautiful. Yeah. And I want to heighten that awareness with what I'm doing. And that's been my dream for many, many years. And everybody around me know that because I go there very much.
You know, we know about the high points of Rome because we see it on film.
That's right.
We know about the high points of Britain and the palace. We see it on film, on Paris. We don't see much of Africa on film. We see Africa as misery and Africa as problems. We do not see it as being this phenomenally endowed continent of sand and sea and oil and resources. Yeah.
The world is jealous of Africa for many centuries because the natural resources are phenomenal. It really is. And it is the dawn of civilization. Our history, a lot of our Bible history, is right there in Africa. And King Tut, all of great civilizations, that is right there in Africa. Egypt is in Africa. And they always try to separate the two, but Egypt is Africa.
Well, it certainly is true that when Jesus was threatened with death, when Herod sent out the edict for genocide for all the firstborn babies, that Joseph took him to Egypt, to Africa, and kept him there for 12 years.
That's right. That's right.
You've shown an amazing level of depth and commitment. Let me say this in closing, Michael, because people are listening, and the reason I didn't open up the lines today because you're sharing stuff with us we never quite really hear. But as people go and watch the trial next week and the coming days, what do you want your fans? We have calls on here right now from London and Holland and all around America. So people are listening today to you. What do you want to say to your fans and supporters, even to your detractors today?
I just want to say, fans in every corner of the earth, every nationality, every race, every language, I love you from the bottom of my heart. You know, thank you for your love and support and understanding during this trying time. I would love your prayers and your goodwill. Please be patient and be with me and believe in me because I am completely, completely innocent. But please know a lot of conspiracy is going on as we speak.
Well, it's Easter time. We fall down. We get back up again. The good news is that nothing is too hard for God. And those who believe, fervently believe, no matter how far down, that they reach for a rope and not a shovel, they'll be pulled up and they will rise again. Michael, thank you for sharing yourself with the nation today and the world and for getting up so early in California.
God bless you.
God bless you and keep up alive. Talk to you in a minute off the air, okay?
Bye-bye.